The first reading this morning is one of the most remarkable passages in the whole of the Hebrew Bible, and it's the fitting climax to a series of readings that we've had over the last few Sunday mornings that come from two remarkable voices, two of the great prophets of Israel in the 8th century BC, their near contemporaries, Amos and Hosea. You'll find them tucked away at the back of the New Testament among the so-called minor prophets. Minor because they're short in length, not minor because they're minor in their significance. On the contrary, we had a little run of readings from Amos. You remember Amos, the shepherd and the keeper of sycamore trees, the man who walked out one day and looked at the world around him and said, "This cannot be right. This kind of a society cannot stand in the presence of the goodness and the holiness of God. We have built," he said to his contemporaries, "a society that's founded upon injustice and on the oppression of the poor, taking people into modern slavery." And God, being utterly good and holy, faced with this world, the world must be swept away in a great outpouring of God's wrath. Let justice rain down like mountains and righteousness like an everlasting stream, he says. Amos is the prophet of the goodness and the holiness and the justice of God. And there is a sense in which there is no hope in the book of Amos, because God is truly good and holy. And if that's true about God, then there is no hope for humankind at all. No hope for the sort of world that we construct in our greed and in our sinfulness. Amos, the prophet of the wrath of God. I had a paradoxical teacher of the Hebrew Bible used to set an essay question: "There is no hope in Amos, discuss." And when you talked about it with him, he'd say, "Well, the reason there is hope in Amos is because there is no hope in Amos. There's no hope in Amos because God is truly good and holy, and his goodness and his holiness and his justice are entirely without compromise." Let me turn to Hosea, from whom we heard words this morning. Hosea, too, is extremely critical of the society that he sees around him. He, too, sees the kind of wickedness that human people do. He also sees the sort of religious faithlessness that is around him. That's an element of the sinfulness of the people that he picks up on more than Amos. Amos tends to be concerned with social injustice. Hosea, a little bit more with the worshipping of false gods. But in chapter 11, Hosea introduces the most extraordinary idea. "When Israel was a child," this is God speaking, "I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." That is to say, with Moses brought out the Israelites from Egypt. "The more I called them, the more they went from me. They kept sacrificing to the Baals, the foreign gods of the Canaanites, and offering incense to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk." Ephraim is a synonym for Israel. "I took them up in my arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of human kindness, with bands of love." And actually the image here, it doesn't come across in this translation, is of a parent teaching a child to walk with walking reins. "It was I," says God, "who put the walking reins on my child Israel and taught Israel to walk. I was to them like people who lift infants to their cheeks. I bent down to them and fed them." God feels towards his people as a parent feels towards a small child, their own small child. It's often said when this passage is discussed that this is an example of God being thought of as a mother. Fred, I think that's falling into a trap of thinking that imagery of power and strength is necessarily male and imagery of caring and nurture is necessarily female. We're straight into men are from Mars and women are from Venus and all that. I see no reason why this should not be a male God equally as a female God, a God beyond all human gendering who is teaching this beloved child to walk.